Before we do that and get into our scriptures this morning, I want to ask you a few questions. I don't know about you, but I love the Bible. I love the scriptures. It's God's revelation to us. It's His inspired, authoritative word. It never changes like man. And I don't know about you again, but I have a special book that I like more than others. I have a kind of a favorite book, and it's this book of Ecclesiastes. Really, all the wisdom books, I love them, because in the books they answer the questions of life. The questions that nobody has but God, really. You can take courses on all kinds of topics, but you can never take a course on wisdom. Wisdom is something given by God. God's wisdom is given by God. But I want to ask you a couple of questions. First one is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. What gain has the worker from his toil? You ever been discouraged? Ever been depressed? You look at life like Solomon in the first chapters of the book, and he's pondering life from an under the sun perspective, horizontally looking only from his own thoughts. He looks at nature. If you can, you can turn there if you want to just scan through, and he says the world is just like a clock. It's wound up, it keeps going and going, the weather and so on. And he just has this wearying, depressing attitude, it seems, in the first couple of chapters of the book. But have you ever been that way? You look at life and you say, what's the use? What gain does the worker have from his toil? After all, you might say, what's the profit of my job? What's the profit of my work? Every time I turn around, someone has their hand in my pocket for my money that I've worked for. Or you might say, what do they think they are entitled to my money? Why do they think this way? At every turn, it seems, the tax collector does. Right? Or you might say, I've worked for a long time in my profession. And it looks like Social Security won't be there for my retirement years that I will depend on. Or maybe my 401k has been devalued. And you say, what is the use of this? These things concern you? Maybe they annoy you sometimes. Same thing, different day. Tomorrow, Monday morning, back to the grind, right? You've heard all these things. It's real. It's real. I've been there. In some ways, I am there. But you know what? God, He has a plan. We saw that in the scriptures reading. There is a time for everything. Everything has its time. That's the workplace. Maybe you're young mothers. Or maybe you who have been mothers. You know the drill. You're up to your elbows in dishpan water. Kids are running around, screaming. The piles of laundry are getting larger and larger. They're not going down. And you think to yourself, what is this? What did I get myself into? Does it ever stop? I know, because I have a wife, and we've had 5 children, and she's had her days. We all have them. But what do you do with them? Is there a time for those things? Well, let's take a look at Solomon, because we want to look at his life a little bit as an introduction before we get into the book, because it will help us to understand why is Solomon saying these things that he's saying in this book. So let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 2. First Kings chapter 2. We see that Solomon, the son of David, and he's inheriting the kingdom in chapter 2. David has died, and he gives the kingdom to his son Solomon in chapter 2. And then, if you've read about Solomon at all, you see the famous prayer and blessing in chapter 3, and that's what we'll look at. Chapter 3, verse 9 through 14, we see this. It says, Solomon is praying here, and he says this: Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people? It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this, and God said to him, Because you have asked this, and have not asked for yourself long life, or riches, or the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. And if you will walk in my ways and keep my statutes, as your father David did, walked, then I will lengthen your days. What a great promise. What a great prayer. Oh, to be like Solomon at this point, to pray for these things. I just want wisdom, Lord. I just want to know how to live my life. And that was Solomon's heartbeat, really. And so we have this prayer, and God gives him wisdom. He promises wisdom and riches. Look at it. Go turn over to 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 14, for we see here just a glimpse, really, of Solomon's riches. You can look and read Kings as you go into the book, and you'll see there's just a huge amount of detail about the riches that Solomon had. For he built the temple, and the ornate decorations that he put into that temple are far from mediocre. It's incredible what Solomon did with the temple. But in 1 Kings 10:14, we have just a little snapshot of what some of the riches that Solomon had. Now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. Besides that, which came from the explorers and from the business of the merchants and from all the kings of the west and from the governors of the land. So if you look at this text right here, 666 talents of gold. Now we don't talk in those terms, we don't use that kind of measurement, but in today's measurements, by the standards of today, that'd be $20 million a year. And then, if you look in verse 15, besides that, there was more. Solomon is a wise and shrewd businessman. We'll see that as we go into Ecclesiastes a little bit, as some of the things that he did and some of the accomplishments that he made and had. But besides that, so it's $20 million a year, and then beyond that, the businesses that he was involved in. So we see that God has given Solomon riches, he has given him wisdom, and he also gives him popularity. Look at chapter 10, verse 23 and 24. Thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And the whole earth came and sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. So you see in that last phrase what God had done in the heart and the mind and the pocketbook of Solomon. Blessed him beyond measure, exceedingly abundantly above anything he probably could have thought at the time. So now let's turn to Ecclesiastes. Let's go to our book. So you see the background for this book. Solomon is king, he's wise, he's rich, he's probably handsome, I don't know. He has 1,000 women, you know, 700 wives, 300 concubines. He's got it all by today's standards, right? Who wouldn't want what Solomon had in all of the blessings that God gave to him? But we have in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, before we get to our text, we have an account of some of the things he did with his wisdom and his riches. So you can scan the page as I read along. I'm just going to go right through it quickly, and you can just scan and look through and in your own time read and ponder some of those things. But in verse 1, just take a look here on the page. Verses 1 through 3, he sought pleasure. Verse 4, he built houses, planted vineyards. Verse 5, he made parks and gardens. He planted trees irrigation systems. He had many servants, herds, flocks, more than anyone in of his day. He amassed riches and wealth, 700 wives, 300 concubines. He surpassed everyone of his day and was wise. And he sums it all up in verse 10. He says that he basically got everything he wanted. He worked hard and he played hard. Solomon was a go-getter, no question about it. And he had everything he needed to get it, get what he wanted. And he did. But something happened in Solomon's life that brought him to verse 11. He looks back in these chapters and he looks back at what he had and he says in 2:11, he says this, Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended doing it. And behold, get this, all was vanity and striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. That's an amazing statement if you think about it. Here's a guy who has it all. And he looks at it all. Solomon here is at sort of the end of his life. He's at the end of his days. And he looks back over his life and he says, it's empty. Vanity. It's a puff of smoke. It's like the steam on the tea kettle. Just wandering to nothing. Really, Solomon? That's amazing. If I could just have a fraction of a fraction, you know, I'd be happy, we say, right? Just one bar of gold. Never mind the 20 million or the 666 talent. Not even one talent. Just a little bit. Maybe half a bar of gold, even. Wouldn't be bad. Well, I think there's a reason why Solomon is where he is. But because when Israel became a nation, God told the Israelites something about their kings, how they were to have a king, what their kings were to be like. And in Deuteronomy, you can turn there, you don't have to, if you don't want to, I'll read it. But in Deuteronomy, God gave very specific instructions to pick a king, much like he gives instructions to pick an elder or a deacon or somebody of any kind of position in the church or so on. But in Deuteronomy 17, verses 16 and 17, we see this about the kings. God says, only about the king, he must not acquire many horses or for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. Well, you know what? Right out of the gate, Solomon did them all. He did it all. Everything that God told him not to do, he did it. Basically. Right out of the gate. He's the third king of Israel, and this is what we have going on. He has a foreign wife, he amasses horses, and he amasses gold and silver. So we take a look at his life at the time of Ecclesiastes. 1 Kings 11:4, if you're still there, I said to hold the placer. In 1 Kings 11:4, it says this, "For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord, his God, as was the heart of David, his father." Now let's turn again to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. So in 2:11 of Ecclesiastes, Solomon writes this, "Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind. and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Now this word toil, I want to draw your attention to it. This word toil is basically work. Work, the general word for work. It could mean your employment. It could mean your housework. It could mean anything. Children, adults. It means just general, whatever you have to do. You got to cut the grass. You got to go to work in the morning on Sunday, Monday. You've got to, whatever it is, do the dishes, do the, whatever it is, doesn't matter. You got to get the idea. It's a word, toil. It means work, to do things, projects, whatever. It's not necessarily just employment. So please put that in your mind. It could be schoolwork, students, children, young people, college. Doesn't matter. Whatever the work you have to do is what Solomon means by this word. For Solomon, it was bigger. We look at what he did. We'll probably never do those things, but it doesn't matter because the word means just work, just stuff to do, busyness of life. Okay? So keep that in mind as we go down through and talk about this idea of toil and what is the benefit of toil, of work, of being busy. Well, at this point in Ecclesiastes, as you can see in the opening chapters, Solomon is very much self-absorbed. He is so self-focused. He says, if you look down through there, you know, here's a guy who has it all by the world standards. Everything money can buy and more. He has wisdom, he has power, he has wealth, he has popularity, prestige, all of it. He has it all. And it made me think of this this song that came out actually in 1969, and it was written by, I'm not going to date myself because I never really listened to it, but written by this man by the name of Paul Anka and sung by Frank Sinatra. And the name of the song is My Way. It's kind of a catchy little sobering song if you listen to it, and it just stirs, you know, just to stir the emotion about basically feeling good about being self-focused. That's what it is. And in the song, it tells the story of a man who's grown old, and he reflects on his life as death is approaching. The end is near, I think, is one of the phrases in the song. He's comfortable with his mortality and takes responsibility for how he dealt with all the challenges of his life while maintaining some respectable degree of integrity. Well, that's Solomon. He did it his way. If that song was ever to describe a man, it would certainly be Solomon. And then we look at Solomon right out of the gate in the first few verses of chapter 1. He uses this word vanity. He says in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2, he says, "Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." So you got to understand, here's Solomon. The end of his days, he's disobeyed God. He's made a mess of his life, basically, because of his disobedience. He's built all these things. He's done all these things. And he comes and he looks at his life and he says, it's empty. It's empty. It's just vaporizing steam off of the tea kettle. Well, you got to understand that the word or the concept in Ecclesiastes is vanity. It's the futility of trying to be happy apart from God. And that's what Solomon is. He's the wisest, richest, most influential king in Israel's history, looks at life under the sun, and from a human perspective, declares it all to be empty. Power, prosperity, popularity, prestige, pleasure. It's all empty. It's all empty. But what drove Solomon to this conclusion? Why? Is Ecclesiastes just this musings of a pessimistic old king? Cynical old king? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. It's brutally realistic about life, really. You look at 1:3. It says, "What does a man gain by all the toil in which he toils under the sun?" Then in 2:20, he says, "So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun." And this brings us to answer the question of Ecclesiastes 3:9. What gain has the worker from his toil? Well, this word gain is just simply some benefit. Doesn't necessarily mean a monetary value. It's any benefit. It could mean money. It could mean a lot of things. It's got some kind of gain, something that helps us, right? And so he says there is none, right? What's the gain? What's the point? Well, this is another important concept to understand in the book of Ecclesiastes. When you see this phrase here, when Solomon asked the question from an under the sun viewpoint, that's important. Think about it. Think about our world under the sun. We're on the earth under the sun. That's it. Beyond that, that's a different story. But right under everything, the horizontal level, this place, this world, is what he's getting at. He's looking at life here and now only. Nothing beyond the under-the-sun idea. So when you see that in the book, pay attention to that, because that's Solomon's viewpoint as he asks the questions, as he makes the statements under the sun. I'm not looking anywhere else, he says, under the sun. And so notice he again is very self-absorbed and self-focused. Notice in chapter 1 through 23, just scanning that text, you can see he says, I did this and I did that. And I made this, and I made that. All these things about I. How many I's are in that text? Count them sometime. But he's so self-absorbed. He's so self-focused. He's looking at himself. He's looking at his life. He's looking at his history. He's looking at his past. Looking at his wives. Whatever. He's looking at his money. And he says, it's empty. It's useless. It does no good. But, really, this is where Solomon starts to begin. He begins to see clearly. As we move on through the text, what does an under the sun perspective look like? Well, we can certainly see it from our text. Maybe you think this way, and you don't even realize it. I know at times I can. Monday morning comes, Tuesday comes, and it's like I look around and I think, "Wow, what's happening? What's going on? I don't get it." I scratch my head. You become despondent sometimes in some of the things that go on in your life, in the world. Why is that? It's because I'm not looking above the sun. That's the problem. I'm looking horizontally. And you probably do too, oftentimes, right? I get so wrapped up in the day-to-day focus of life, the stuff that keeps us busy and get sidetracked. But Ecclesiastes shows us that many of the pursuits of life, including wealth, education, power, really don't bring any lasting joy. They really don't. And they can't. That's why. Why is this? Because they can't. They weren't designed for that. God did not design blessings to make us happy, to fulfill us. He didn't. He gave us those things to make our place and stay here just a little bit easier until we meet Him one day. So if you're looking for fulfillment in any of those things, you're chasing a lie fed to us by the philosophy of our day. It will not satisfy you. None of these things can or will, because they were not designed for that purpose. So what does this idea of reasoning, as Solomon puts it, under the sun look like? Solomon's statements throughout the book plague many. Every generation, really, asks the same questions about life. There are 26 under-the-sun statements in Ecclesiastes that Solomon ponders and thinks about. And I'm just going to go over some of them very quickly. It's just they're in there. And these are the things you might say. Some of these things, you know what? Sound like they're right off of the bestseller list in the latest books. Or if you're a talk show radio listener, the topics that they discuss week after week after week with no answers are probably in this list. And so really, we're no different than the days of Solomon, if we look around. But he ponders this. He ponders work and toil under the sun. He says nothing changes under the sun in verse 1, chapter 1, verse 9. Nothing. It's always the same thing. Day after day, the weary round of life. It just goes on like a ticking clock. And then under the sun, he looks at everything we do is like chasing the wind. It's you just can't get a break. You can't grab onto anything. Again, work gains nothing in chapter 2. Then he goes on, whether you are wise or a fool, there'll be no enduring remembrance of you. He ponders that under the sun. Again, all that you and I amass will be given to someone who didn't work for it and probably or may not use it wisely. You collect your inheritance, leave it to somebody else, squandered. See, Solomon sees this going on in his day. He's older. He's seen this go on. How about this? Corrupt justice. He thinks about that. Corrupt justice. The law courts. He talks about oppression. One people or person taking advantage by force over another people or person. People, group, or person. He even says with oppression that a person is better off dead or not being born at all under the pressure of oppression. He talks about the workaholic in 4:7. He questions government change. Government's going on in his day. He thinks about the frustration of investments gone bad, even though the person may have been wise in the pursuit. He scratches his head with that under the sun. He wrestles with the idea that God blesses a man and he can't even enjoy the blessings but leaves them to someone else. He wrestles with not knowing the future. And then he wrestles with this one. I'm sure we can all identify with this one. Because evil is not in this world visibly punished, men become confident and bold in sinning all the more. He's pondering this stuff and he's saying, man, it's crazy. It's vanity. It's empty. It's useless. How about this one? Last one. Error that proceeds from rulers. Corrupt politicians. Kings. Are familiar with that? Does this stuff bother you when you look at it under the sun? You scratch your head and you say, look at the injustice. Well, without God's solution to these things, there are no solutions. But these, you know, these things that that Solomon mentions and talks about, they're real and normal and worthy of concern for us. They really are. And they should concern us. All of us at some time in one way or another are going to think about these things and scratch your head and walk away and say, why? What is going on? Right? And you know what? Should we be despairing about these things? No. And we're going to see this as we move ahead here in a few minutes. But should we work for change in those things? Absolutely. Whenever there's an opportunity for change in some of these concerns and problems, we should. We should. But it shouldn't consume us to the place of despair. Never. And many have and do work some of these things out in our culture. We're going to look at that at the end about a man who worked for some of these injustices. And so let's answer the question this morning before us. And I want to look at three things, three truths about work or toil or busyness that we must understand as we live life on this planet, not under the sun, but beyond the sun, in the economy of God. So the first one we want to look at here is, what is the profit? I'm going to answer the question, what is the profit or gain from having work, right? Well, the first thing we have to have is a correct perspective about the world. You know, Randy read this morning a text of Scripture, and it just went on and on. There's a time for this, there's a time for that, and time for that, and it just went on and on. And we had to understand that God is the one who has a time for everything. And so when Solomon comes to this realization in his mind, that's when the light goes off, on for him. And he sees that he's getting a clearer perspective. Well, the first one we want to look at is, he says it right in the text, we're not going to move far from our text for these three points, he says, we're not going to move away at all. It says that work is given by God, first of all. In the text before you, he says this, I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Now, we've been told recently that if you've gained something, if you're successful in your business, you did not get there on your own. Maybe some of you heard that recently. Well, that's true. That's true. That's a true statement. But it kind of has left sort of a dot, dot, dot at the end and left it off, because it says right here that God has given you work to do. And again, whatever that work is, it doesn't have to be employment. It's God has given it. Randy read it. There's a time for this, a time for that, and God has placed those things in their proper place. So work is given by God. All right? And so he may use various means, but it comes from God. You may get an education. You may know somebody. Or there may be all kinds of ways that you get work, any kind of work or job. But ultimately, it's God. If you have a business, God gave it to you. If you have a job, God gave it to you. If you have work to do at the house, that's God's toil for you that day. Whatever it is, whatever you have to do, God is giving you that to do. Right? Here and now, every day. Maybe he takes away a job. Maybe he does. There's a time for that. He says it in Ecclesiastes. I mean, you know, Solomon couldn't write all the details there. But there's a time for unemployment, and there's a time to work. There's a time to lose your 401k. You know, this is what happens. That's the general idea of what Solomon is saying. He can't know all of the details about life. Well, he can't if God gives it to him. But you get the point, what Solomon is trying to say there. Whatever happens is because of God doing it, whatever it is. All right? But we have a great example here about work. We look at a couple of things. For example, God works. Right? Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created. You think he just, you know, didn't do anything? No, he created. And then we have in Genesis a whole account of his creation. God was busy. God was working. It didn't make him tired, but that's what he did. He works. He's always working. He works in his material world, in creation, and also he works in his non-physical world. Look at turn for you, if you will, to Ephesians chapter 3, and I want to read a verse there for you to look at, and actually put a marker in Ephesians, because we're going to go back there again in a few minutes. But God works in his physical world in creation. We see this in Genesis 1, and we are created to work. For example, in Genesis 2:15, we have the account here before us. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. So God is a worker, and he's made us like him to be workers. He made us to work, to toil, to have busyness, to do things. Well, the second one, which is really a blessing to us, especially, is how he works in the material, in the immaterial world, in the heart and mind of his people, and it's nonstop. Look at Ephesians chapter 3, verse 20. Now to him who is able, that's God, to keep us, to do far more abundantly than all we ask or think, according to, here it is, power at work in us. God is continually working at work in us. Now think about it. Globally, Christians around the world, globally, simultaneously, God is working in each person all the time, all the time. In this room, he's working in your thinking right now, all of us at the same time. That's mind-boggling. But that's how God is. He works. Philippians 2:13, Paul writes, he says, for it is God who works in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Okay? So we have, that's God. He works. Work is given to us by God, because when we work, we're like God, really. That's the image of God in us. We have been created to work. We saw that in the garden. We have an example of God working, and we're to be like that. So if you want to have profit under the sun, as you see life and the problems and the toil that you have, think this. God has given it to you to do. God has given it to you to do. All right? So really, our toil, our jobs, our work, our busyness should really point us Godward. when you have something to do, it should point you to God. You got limbs, you can move them, you can work, you can do things, hands, feet, shake your head, speak, right? God has given it to us so that we will work. So it should point us Godward, and we should be thankful for the work that God gives to us. Whatever it might be, as simple as it is, it doesn't matter. We should be thankful to God for those things. It points us back to the creation account. We have been made for work. So enjoy your work, and we're going to look at that too in a few minutes. But notice another phrase in verse 10 of chapter 3. It says that we are to be busy with work that we are to be busy with. Well, I'm gonna maybe step on some toes here. Now, I don't know, you know, ouching. But you know, it applies to me too. So we're all in this together. But it's something that I think about sometimes, or oftentimes, I guess, more than I should, maybe under the sun. I don't know. But a concern that I have for our generation and the next one coming is this: that we are becoming, instead of workers, we are becoming lazy. We see laziness in the workplace. Do you see it? If you're in the workplace, we see laziness in the home. And even we see laziness in the church. There's many things to do, much work to do in all of those things, but yet we become lazy. In many ways, we have become products of our culture, and sometimes we become consumed with entertainment and leisure instead of labor. Leisure instead of labor. We are becoming worshipers of the idol named leisure. Many today focus on rest when they should focus on work. What about you? What about me? First thing that comes into your mind, is it work? Toil? Things to do? Or is it, let's put the feet up and I'll do that later? Put it off till tomorrow. You know, the procrastinator's model. Why put off today what you can do tomorrow? We're plagued by that, I think, as people. It's a tendency, oftentimes. We focus on rest instead of work. Have you succumbed to the, what can I get from, fill in the blank, what can I get from, versus what can I give to this? Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Please don't. Rest is good. God made us for work, and He made us for rest. We have in the Scriptures actually a command to keep the Sabbath day. Keep a day of rest, right, in the Old Testament. So God does give us rest. He's built us for work, and He's built us for rest. But God works all those days, and then He takes a rest day, right? What's the fraction? What's the percentage of that? God ordained a day of rest, and He ordered rest in its proper time and its proper place, and we've been created for both. But Proverbs 20:13 says, "Love not sleep, lest you come to poverty. Open your eyes, and you will have plenty of bread." But a twisted view of rest leads to another problem in our culture called entitlement. You ever heard of entitlement? Well, entitlement simply means having a sense of being owed something just because something is desired. I want it. Hey, I'm owed it. I want this. I think I should get it. That's the idea. And we see that all around us. It's so prevalent that a term has been coined dealing with it called the entitlement generation. Believe it or not, I looked it up. There's an actual phrase and a definition called the entitlement generation. We have gone from the me generation to the entitlement generation. The me generation, again, has a definition. The generation originally in the 1970s, characterized by self-absorption. In the 1980s, characterized by material greed. And then, coming from that, came the entitlement generation. In this generation, the definition is this: the group born between 1979 and 1994, get this, who believe they are owed certain rights and benefits without further justification. That's right. That's what we're dealing with today, right? The entitlement generation. So if you were born between 1979 and 1994, that's your generation, so this definition says. And it is becoming the norm. You look around, talk to people. As a culture, so often people think they are entitled to, here's a list. You can add to it, but I've got a few here. More ease, more money, more benefits, more holidays, more government programs, more entertainment, more vacation, more sick days, more education, more enjoyment, more opportunities for success, more fill in the blank. I mean, the list is endless. It goes on and on. As big as the imagination is, this list could be that big. But really, you know something? We're not entitled to any of these things, really. You'll find nothing in the scriptures that say we're entitled to any of those things. Turn to Ephesians chapter 6, verse 5. I want to just relate this to the workplace and look at what Paul writes about the workplace. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 5, he says this. Wait for the pages to stop. But in Ephesians 6, 5, he talks to the slaves. And really, the idea of the slave at this time is not like the slaves that our nation was embroiled in the 1800s. Not that kind of slavery. The slavery of the Bible days is more like a worker, a servant who would be taken. And actually, in the Old Testament, Israel was told to care for your slaves. Treat them like people, not like animals, and care for them. And there's a whole economy on slavery that the Bible talks about, and it's nothing like what we experience in this nation. So he talks to the slaves, the servants, he says, be obedient to those who are your masters or your employers. Put in today's words. According to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in the sincerity of your heart as to Christ, and not by way of eye service as men pleasers, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. Okay? So we have here, the slaves are addressed, and you see, it's not an under-the-sun focus. It's a bigger picture than that. It goes vertical. You work for somebody, you're working for God. So work as God is watching you, because that's who you're working for. Right? God has given us the work, the toil that we have. And so we need to act and work accordingly. That Jesus is my boss. Jesus is watching everything I do at every moment of every day on the work, in the workplace, or in the home, or in the church, wherever you're working, cutting the grass, you know, whatever it is. Really, you may think that's simplistic, but it's true. God ordains our days for us, and he gives us work to do, whatever that might be. Well, now, he goes on, Paul says in Ephesians, he says in verse 8, knowing that whatever good thing one does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether slave or free. Now, he talks to the masters, the employer. He says, do the same things to them, and give up threatening, knowing that both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. So if you're a business owner and you hire people, or you're a worker for a business, you see what God has for us. It's a Godward focus. That's what we're to do. So really, both ends of the spectrum, you're not owed anything. You're not owed anything. You have a responsibility and a job to do before God. Employer, treat your help right. Employee, treat your boss right. Yeah, but my boss doesn't, he doesn't do it, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what your boss does. God says, you treat him right. Right? The employer might say, well, my workers, they're deadbeats. They're just, you know, they're always late. You can fire them, but I mean, he says you can't threaten them. You can't talk ill against them. We have to be sweet and kind. I mean, take steps to, you know, we have to, discipline is right. That's necessary, but it's how we do it, really. So we're not owed anything by God. We're not entitled to anything other than what God gives us. Or, if you make a contract, then you're entitled to that contract. That's right. That's a good thing. If you have an agreement with somebody, then you're owed that. You can request that. You can require that be fulfilled. There's no problem with that. But other than that, we're not owed anything. We have no entitlement to anything of other people. So entitlement generation, you must understand these things. Okay? So when you come across it, as you talk to people, start correcting this in your culture, in our culture. We are not owed anything. Point number two, understand that God's plan for your work or your toil, your business is perfect. It's a perfect plan. Make no mistake about it. No matter what you're doing, it's perfect. It's God's plan. Look at verse 11 of chapter 3. In the context of toil and work and business, God says, Solomon writes, He has made everything beautiful in its time. He is absolutely provident over all of the events of your life and my life. He says, we read it, right? Ecclesiastes 3:1. For everything, there is everything. Everything, there is a season and a time for every matter. Every matter. It's in there. Not some matters, every matter. Under heaven. See, Solomon's changing from under the sun, and now he uses the word under heaven. He's getting a little bit further up. He's getting a focus on God here. And he says, under heaven ought to be where we get our worldview, our view of life, not under the sun. Let's get beyond here and now, the horizontal spectrum, where God lives, where God's throne is, God's perspective. That's what we need to help us thrive in this world. Ecclesiastes 9:10. Look at this one. Turn there, 9:10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or thought of or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. To the grave. We're all going to the grave. And all the stuff that's done here, it's done. You're not going to gain any more wisdom. Well, you will when you get to the throne of God. But worldly wisdom, earthly wisdom, and knowledge, and reward, it's just it. This is it. This is where it happens right here. And so he says to do it all. Why? Well, we're going to see that. He says he's made everything beautiful in its time. And can you say that about the work that you have to do? About the toil that you're involved in? We're going to have to move quickly because I have a lot of material left and I really want to get through it. So I'm just going to blast. Okay, here we go. Can you say that about your work that you're busy with? It's a reality sometimes that's difficult to reconcile, but we have to. It's very important. Point number three. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart in verse 3:11, chapter 3:11. He says, yet so that he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that, or you could say it this way, without God, he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. God puts the desire in our heart to look to him to figure out these hard questions. And see, Solomon has not done this in some of his life. He's not looked to God to answer the hard questions. And it's only when we look to God to give us the answers to the hard questions is when we can divorce ourselves from despair and enjoy our life before him. So God puts us a desire in our hearts to look to him to figure out these hard questions. And by the way, when you read, see the word evil in this book, it's not necessarily like sinful, you know, activity. It's just a word that means it's hard, it's difficult, it's calamitous. And so that's what it means. It's not like this sinful thing. It's just a hard thing. And so Solomon here, he brings us these hard questions, and really in Ecclesiastes, Solomon is in a very good place. He is a good example of a man with eternity in his heart at this point. Solomon looks at his world, and in chapter 12 chapters, he asks a total of 28 questions about life. 28, as he thinks about his life, the past. So what's the takeaway for Solomon about these truths? What's the main thing? What's the big picture in this book? Well, we're going to find that only God has the answers to life's hard questions, and those answers are not always easy to take. You think about John chapter 21 when he appears to Peter, and he's telling Peter how he's going to die. And so he says, you know, this is how you're going to die. And then Peter says, well, what about John? What about him? And Jesus basically says, it's none of your business. really. He says, what is that to you, Peter? What difference does that make? And he doesn't tell him. But he's, you know, you think Jesus, well, maybe Jesus is a little harsh there, you know. But see, God has it all wired. We saw this in Ecclesiastes that there's a time and a place for everything, and God has made everything perfect. So really, when we don't understand, it's not our business. God has it under control. Let God be God and let us be us. God has it all under control, not to worry. So the place that we get when we worry is because we're thinking under the sun. We're thinking on a horizontal level versus in a vertical dimension. So let's look at this. I can't say really any better than Solomon, so we're going to read what Solomon has to say to some of these things. Turn to chapter 3, verse 12. He says, I perceive that there is nothing better for them. Now, see, this is where Solomon, he's understanding God. He's listening. He's looking at God. He's looking at his life and he's saying, it's despairing. It's troubling. It's a problem. I can't take it anymore. But now, he looks vertical and this is the conclusion that he comes to. Look how simple this is. He doesn't look at all of the works that he's done and his money and his wives and his horses and his kingdom. He boils it right down. The simplistic things. Look what he says here. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. So also, look at this. Look how simple this is. This is where we ought to be as we're living our life in our world that's full of the stuff that Solomon went through. He says here, he says also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. He says, this is God's gift to man. It's not the big stuff. It's not the success. It's not the college education, though those things might be good. It's not money. It's not big houses. It's not notoriety. It's none of those things that matter. Solomon says it right here. He's come to his senses finally. He's wiped away the fog off the window. He's looking out. Now he's seeing it very clearly. He goes on to say, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything can be taken from it. God has done it so that people fear or respect. There's another word for that word, fear. It's a respectful term. They have respect for God. And so he goes on, chapter 9, turn there, chapter 9, verses 7 through 12, he says basically, death is coming. Death is coming, so go. Eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. These are cultural things you can study on your own. Enjoy the wife or spouse, you could say, of your youth, right, whom you love, all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun. Because that is your portion in life. And in your toil, at which you toil under the sun. That's your portion. The other stuff, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's not for us to worry about. We shouldn't be despairing about those things. And this is where the temporal and the eternal meet here, the bigger picture in verse 10. He says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Why, Solomon? Why? Why do it all with all might? Why enjoy all of these things? Well, he tells us. He says, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol. When the grave comes, all that's done here, it's gone. So right now, what you're doing counts really forever. Because after this, it's done. And then we all stand before God's judgment for how we dealt with these things. We'll give an account one day. We're moving on in our text. Again, I can't say it any better than Solomon, so I'm just going to read it. Why reinvent the wheel, right? Again, I saw that under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happens to them all. Now, this idea of chance, don't think it's just, you know, throwing the dice and we... Oh, no, see, there's my, that's what happened. It's just lucky, you know. Now, the chance that Solomon is writing about is also used in, the idea is used in Proverbs 16:33. He says this, the lot is cast into the lap, But it's every decision is from the Lord. Don't think that you get some lucky break, right? You're at the right place at the right time. No, God is very involved with that. Because Solomon says, time. There's a time and place for everything. We read that earlier again. There's a time for everything. And then he goes on in verse 12, for man does not know his time. Like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of man are snared at an evil time or a hard time when it suddenly falls upon them. The book of Ecclesiastes has a powerful message for our selfish, materialistic age. It teaches that great accomplishments and earthly possessions alone do not bring lasting happiness. They can't. They were not designed for that. True satisfaction comes, really, from serving God, following His will for our lives, having a Godward focus in all things. Right? But there's another important truth in Ecclesiastes, which we often overlook, is that life is to be enjoyed. Life is to be enjoyed. Solomon repeats this truth several times so it does not escape our notice. He says in chapter 3, verses 12 and 13, he says, for there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in their lives, and so also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. What a tremendous blessing. You see how simple it can be? God makes it simple for us, but yet we muddy it up so bad sometimes. God's will for us to enjoy the simple blessings of life as He provides them. Our grateful acceptance of His daily blessings really can cause and bring a sense of joy and deep fulfillment in our lives. We're almost done. Okay? Almost done. Young people, I want to address you now, the young ones in this audience, this room. Because Solomon is saying something to you. Remember, Solomon is old now. He is the wisest man, right, of his day. Wiser than any, the Bible tells us. And so he's going to speak to you now. If you're young, I don't know how you want to define young, but listen, you think about it. Solomon is speaking to you. God is inspiring him to write this to you. Okay, here he goes. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, some of my favorite verses right here. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Verse 1, at the end of the book, the end of the matter, he says this to the young ones. Listen carefully now. Listen closely. If you have a Bible, turn there. Read with me. Don't look at my face. Read it for yourself. Hearing it, reading it, it goes in your brain better that way. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, 1. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. Before the hard days come or the evil days come, and the years draw near, of which you will say this, I have no pleasure in them. And then he goes on and talks about, in a poetic way, how the body breaks down. Life becomes difficult. You can't walk. Your teeth go and your eyes go and your hearing, everything starts to go. And he says, I have no pleasure in them. Who wants to live like that? There's no pleasure there, really, considering the days where you did have those faculties working properly. So remember this, young ones. Remember God now. Remember Him now. Because when the days do come, He says, they're coming. Unless the Lord comes first, hopefully. But if He doesn't, the hard days are coming. So remember God now while you're young. And so you can look back when the hard days come and remember how good God is to us. And then look at verse 13 and 14. He says this, the end of the matter, when you boil it all down, he says this, all has been heard. It's all been heard. It's all been thought about, discussed. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. So what gain does the worker have from his toil? Well, it's only going to come. The gain is that we have a Godward focus in all that we do. I want to close with this example from fairly recent history, church history. I'm going to close with this little article I found. It's very interesting. I thought it was thought-provoking. But William Wilberforce, a British politician and prominent abolitionist, died July 29th, 189 years ago. July, just recently, just came out of July, right? The end of the month, 189 years ago in 1833. Here are three lessons from the man whose faith helped end slavery in England and inspire America's abolitionist movement. Here's a man who took God's work seriously. What his hand found to do, he did it with all of his might for the glory of God. Three crucial lessons from the life of William Wilberforce. Number one, he came to this conclusion. Experience life through the lens of faith. We've been talking about that this morning. Prior to his conversion, William was not known as an industrious individual. As a student at St. John's College, he invested most of his time in social activities in idleness or leisure. William committed himself to frivolity, even after being elected into Parliament at age 21. He said to himself, quote, "The first years in Parliament, I did nothing, nothing to any purpose," close quote. After a sudden conversion experience, William began to see his work and world in a whole new light. He says this, quote, "The gospel, freely admitted, makes a man happy. It gives him peace with God and makes him happy in God. It gives to industry a noble, contented look which selfish drudgery never wore. And from the moment that a man begins to do his work for the Savior's sake, he feels that the most ordinary employments are full of sweetness and dignity, and that the most difficult are not impossible. And if any of you, my friends, is weary with his work, if dissatisfaction with yourself or sorrow of any kind disheartens you, if at any time you feel the dull paralysis of conscious sin or the depressing influence of vexing thoughts, look to Jesus and be happy. Be happy, and your joyful work will prosper well." So, second point he realized was to bloom where you're planted. Bloom where you're planted. William struggled with his Parliament position in the light of his new faith. Religious enthusiasm was not socially accepted in high society, and he worried about finding himself at odds with his peers. For advice, he reached out to Anglican clergyman John Newton, the writer of Amazing Grace. Newton responded by telling William, quote, "It is hoped and believed that the Lord has raised you up for the good of his church and for the good of the nation," close quote. This gave William the encouragement he needed. As he later wrote in his diary, quote, "My walk, I am sensible, is a public one. My business is in the world, and I must mix in assemblies of men, or quit the post which Providence seemed to have assigned me," close quote. His decision to stay in Parliament would help change the nation and end the slave trade. The third and final point that William Wilberforce saw in life was this: have the stamina to pursue your God-given passions until the end. In William's time, more than 11 million people had been captured in Africa and forced into labor in the West Indies, with Britain controlling the majority of that slave trade. Putting an end to Britain's role in this unacceptable practice became William's driving passion, no matter the cost to himself. He says this, quote, "As soon as ever I had arrived thus far in my investigation of the slave trade, I confess to you, sir, so enormous, so dreadful, so immediate did its wickedness appear that my own mind was completely made up for the abolition. A trade founded in iniquity and carried on as this was must be abolished. Let the policy be what is might, what it might. Let the consequences be what they would, I from this time determine that I would never rest till I had effected its abolition. Slavery, a booming business, contributed to much of the British economy. Though few were directly involved in the slave trade, most wealthy families benefited from it somehow. The resistance to abolishing slavery was fierce, but William was resolute. For 20 years, William worked as an abolitionist. 20 years. Often without seeing positive results. Do you ever think that he came to what's the point of it all? Right? The despair of Solomon? Probably did. But on July 26, 1833, the House of Commons voted to abolish the slave trade. Upon hearing the news, William said, quote, "Thank God that I have lived to witness this day," close quote. He died 3 days later. So what's the gain from the worker for his toil? Let's pray. Father, we thank you for Solomon. We look at his life. We look at his sin. It's for all of us to read century after century. You've put it there for us. So oftentimes we're like him. We hear your word. We hear your teaching. And yet we walk away. And we become despondent. No wonder. We get depressed because we look at life under the sun versus above the sun, where you are. So we pray you'd help us to think about these truths this morning, to enjoy the simple things that you provide for us, not always wanting more, expecting more, but to be happy and satisfied with what you give us. It's not easy. Not easy sometimes where hard times come. Things don't look good. But we know that there's a time and purpose for everything, and that you're in control of it all. So as we leave today, we pray you'd impress these things in our mind, and so that we could rejoice with the things that you bless us with. And so that we would have a Godward focus on our toil and work and the things that we are given to do by your hand. Thank you for your involvement in our lives so much every day, all the time, that you give us these things to do for your glory. So help us not to be distracted by the things we see around us, but that we would be focused on you and what you've given us to do. So that we would be like your son, for his meat was to do your will. Help us to think that way, please. So that it would be a light to the dying world around us, as they might see the difference in us and our work ethic, that we would point them to the Savior who was always working before your throne on our behalf. We ask you these things in Jesus' name. Amen.